I'm Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Oh, that is so true, isn't it? What just happened there? Good morning, geniuses. Philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, and of course all you wealthy, holier-than-thou liberals who think that civil rights is how you treat your nanny. Welcome aboard. Nice to see everybody here in the booth. We've got a whole team of tired people here. Monday's a weird day, isn't it, Riley?
Yeah, it is.
I'm trying to pull it together, but you know, my weekend was so filled with self-contempt and insecurity that I'm going to have a hard time because I'm drained from all that work. I did about a million spots of comedy.
Were you all over town?
Well, I was at two clubs. I was at the Boston Comedy Club and at the Comedy Cellar, and I didn't embarrass myself once. Maybe the last show on Saturday was kind of embarrassing. That got a little too personal, and I don't think crying's good. You know, when you're doing a stand-up comedy show and the tears start flowing out of your eyes, it's not funny anymore until one guy goes, "That is funny. That guy's really in pain. This is great." It's a moment that you should cherish.
Yeah. Who was that?
No, I'm kidding, dude. So it was a great weekend. What did you do this weekend before we get into the horrendous situation unfolding before us?
Well, I just sort of relaxed. I chilled out, you know, had some work done in the house and did a little work around the house and had a garage sale.
Uh-huh.
My wife and daughter kind of participated.
Yeah? You had a garage sale? What'd you sell? How come was there anything left over?
Yeah, I wanted to go.
Yeah, where's the gift?
Oh, yeah, sure.
How come no one told us about it?
Well, you need a circular saw, do you?
Sure. I like to have circular saws, but I like having tools I can use.
Yeah, did anyone try to negotiate with you, Riley? Like, no, 75 cents is too much.
No. Let me explain something to you. I didn't do anything. I watched the entire thing go on. But my daughter actually took the money that we raised, which is like over 100 and something bucks, and she's taking it to her school for victims of hurricane Katrina.
That's a very nice gesture for her to show up with that kind of dough at school. You never have one point in time, Riley, where someone made an offer on something you didn't go, "Oh, no.
No, man, I don't see that." My daughter is the negotiator of the stuff. So there may have been a time, maybe around the circular saw sale thing.
Well, let's do this thing. Let's get into this because it seems like the crap is still hitting the fan. It seems that Bush or Karl Rove and Scooter Libby are probably definitely going to be indicted, according to William Kristol of the Weekly Standard. He believes that they're going to be indicted. He's definitely a conservative cat, and they believe they're going to be indicted. We'll get into that in just a second. But yesterday, in an article in the New York Times written by Judith Miller about her own testimony before the grand jury, this article suggests, among other things, that she is still a codependent Republican stooge, my friends. Her journalistic integrity not only comes into question, but there should be questions on all of our minds whether or not she could ever be considered a journalist at all. In the piece, she recollects her testimony before Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury last week on October 12th and before that on September 30th. What we learn is that it is a recollection of not being able to recollect the very source that she was said to be protecting when she chose jail over testifying, Riley.
Well, you know what? Every time her memory goes dim, guess who it benefits?
Scooter Libby or not?
Ka-ching! Scooter Libby.
Yeah, all right.
Every time she says, "Well, I can't remember
where
Valerie Flame came from." You know, it's in my notes on the day that I talked to Scooter Libby, but it's not on the same page as when I talked to Scooter Libby. All of this stuff benefits Libby. Every time she's been vague.
There's something going on between the two of them. It stinks. The whole thing stinks. It sounds like a romance when you look at how it unfolds. Here's what she says, though, in a reference to the newly uncovered notebooks that had Valerie Flame written on top of one of the pages, all right? It said Flame. These notebooks revealed interaction between Miller and Libby weeks before it was assumed they started talking and weeks before the Wilson op-ed appeared in the Times. When asked by Fitzgerald if she could recall discussing the Wilson Flame connection with other sources, she said that she'd had those conversations, but she could not recall any name or conversation that occurred.
Yeah,
so
right.
It wasn't in the notebook and apparently not in her head. How can you not recall? That's such a standard Republican trick to just go, I forgot. What is that?
Well, what it is covering Libby's behind, because when you start looking deeply into what's going on here, and if you start looking into what she has said about her own actions, you see a pattern here that goes back to actually September of 2002, and the White House Iraq Group, which we'll get into a little bit later. But what we see in terms of the vagaries of her memory here, and you know, for somebody to have reams of notebooks and no memory is an amazing thing. You keep seeing over and over again both a reporter who was cut loose essentially from the normal mores of management at the New York Times to pretty much do whatever she felt like doing.
Which has some implications about the New York Times as well. Where are their standards? Where are their rules? Why don't they, you know, why didn't they rein her in? But I don't understand, Riley. It seems, well, first of all, it's very unnerving to me that the conversations, part of the agreement for her to come out of jail and speak to Fitzgerald and testify before the grand jury, the condition was to limit the conversation to Scooter Libby, who was either pressured or coerced to allow her to do that on his behalf, and she protected him, as you said. But given that Libby was her main source and that Libby was pressed from the inside to let her testify in a letter that we'll discuss in a second, first of all, she could have been coached to forget, you know, by him, and there could have had a secret agreement for her to protect him. But why isn't it that we're not saying that there is another source and that she is obviously protecting someone else? Now, it seems to me that the source that she could now be protecting, could it be Cheney, who was at the CIA every other day, it seems, when the Iraq group was putting their propaganda campaign together to sell the war to the public? I mean, they were bullying tenant CIA to give them info they needed. Libby suggests that the CIA was hedging to protect the agency, and ultimately Cheney and the Iraq group got what they wanted. Tenet took the hit. The CIA has been gutted, and most intelligence gathering is done out of the Pentagon now. So why can't we assume that not only is she protecting Libby, which is fine, which isn't going to help him, we already knew what their interaction was, but what is actually at stake here is that Cheney is up to his neck in this thing.
Well, Cheney is up to his neck in this thing. Unfortunately, there's no record of Judith Miller having spoken to Cheney directly, but when you speak to Scooter Libby, essentially you're speaking to Cheney. Libby is his chief of staff. I would find it incredible that Scooter Libby would go off the farm in terms of what Dick Cheney wanted him to say. And I have to say, I got to tell you, Mark, this woman is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and yet she didn't know she was being used by the White House to shield itself from being seen or perceived as attacking Joe Wilson. That's insane.
Dude,
that's absurd.
I think she was seeing Scooter Libby. Come on, if you look at it to me, I mean,
I don't know what Mrs. L thinks about that. Is he married?
I don't know what he is, but if you look at this letter, you know, it seems like there was an almost romantic interaction between her and Scooter Libby, who wanted to be referred to in a research, not as a Cheney's chief of staff, but as a former Hill staffer, which sounds fishy to begin with. And in the letter that he wrote her in jail, telling her to go ahead and talk about him, it ended with this line, quote, "Out west where you vacation, the aspens will already be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them," end quote. Now, either this guy's writing in haikus, or else this is some sort of weird romantic illusion, or else it's actual code, which I can't quite figure out. And she said it was reference to an encounter with Libby in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where she was vacationing after attending a conference on national security issues that was held in Aspen, Colorado. And apparently, listen to this, she was at a rodeo, and a man in jeans and a cowboy hat and sunglasses came up to her and said, "Judy, it's Scooter Libby." How clandestine and weird and cryptic is that? Or is it just romantic? I don't know. But before we take a short pause in our conversation, we should talk a little bit about what is coming to light is that the New York Times, the paper of record, yes?
Yes, the paper of record.
That conservatives accuse of being a liberal outpost is enabling Judith Miller to choose her own defense and do whatever she wants, and has done that for a while, without applying either in-house New York Times standards, which seem to be laxed, if not non-existent, or true journalistic standards to her reporting and her defense. And bottom line, by enabling her to determine how she will conduct her defense, including her saying that she couldn't recall the original source of her first encountering the name Valerie Plame, the New York Times is enabling her to cover up a second leak source, probably, and thus carry water for this corrupt administration. So there goes your assessment of it being a liberal newspaper a little out the window, folks.
Well, I mean, you're talking now about a woman who was able to do an end around her publisher, her executive editor, her foreign editor, her investigative editor, her managing editor, and her Washington bureau chief. All of those different people who were supposed to be exerting some sort of supervision over Judith Miller now say They don't have a clue. And the managing editor, in fact, Jill Abramson, said the entire thing was messed up from the beginning. How do you have, in the wake of what happened to Jason Blair, which caused the executive editor at the time, Hal Raines, to quit or be fired,
yeah,
how in the world do you now say that your standards are so lax that Judith Miller was able to essentially run roughshod, beginning, by the way, in 2002? And we'll get into that a little later as well.
Okay, well, we're gonna talk about Iraq, the Constitution. We're gonna talk about Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, what their plans are post indictment at 16 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
All right, it's 21 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. It's Monday morning. It's always a little difficult on Monday, but I think we're going to make it, folks. I think we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Judith Miller can't seem to recall anything. She can't seem to recall who her secondary source was or who else she talked to about the Valerie Plame leak. She is clearly a codependent Republican stooge, if not, I think, romantically involved with Scooter Libby at some level. She has been since the beginning. She has, carried this administration's water in a journalistic way to serve their propaganda initiatives. This would be the Iraq group comprised of Andrew Card, Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, Mary Matlin, James Wilkinson, Nicholas Callio, Condi Rice, Stephen Hadley, Scooter Libby. This was a group put together essentially to create a efficient and leak-proof campaign to sell the idea of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq to the American people. And Judith Miller facilitated that on the pages of the New York Times. One of her editors apologized for 5 out of 6 articles written about pre-war intelligence and relating to weapons and whether or not they had weapons in Iraq. And 5 of those articles were co-written by Judith Miller, and they were all questionably sourced. Judith Miller, of course, says, hey, I got that one wrong. You can only rely on your sources. Well, maybe you should vet your sources a little better. This woman is dirty up to her neck. She'd never be allowed to write another piece of journalism for any paper ever.
Well, there's some other questions that the New York Times needs to be asking Judith Miller as well, because there came a point when Judith Miller was asked whether or not she was one of, I believe, 6 reporters who had gotten some sourced information from Scooter Libby. She denied it at the time. Now, I don't know how she explains that to folks now, but not that long ago, she was saying, no, that was not my source. Now, it obviously was. And the Times, by the way, got scooped by virtually every other newspaper in the country.
On this. Yeah.
In terms of naming Libby as the source.
Well, all this stuff is going to come to the fore here. It's all going to, we can do all the speculating we want, and there's plenty of people out there in the world, in the blogosphere, really working all the angles on this. All that work is appreciated. I just hope that the grand jury prosecutor Fitzgerald is doing as much, if not more work as you all in terms of putting this thing together and seeking justice. I hope these indictments come down soon because I'm tired of, wrapping my brain around this thing. And apparently, Karl Rove has got a plan for himself. According to professional speculators within the administration, if he is indicted, he will resign or go on unpaid leave. He will sever ties with the Bush administration and not coach him from the sidelines. This is interesting because it's going to be interesting to see an untethered Bush. With no Karl Rove helping him out. Apparently, he's going to have to put all his time into defending himself against what one source close to Rove calls bull charges that he was ever part of a broader conspiracy to discredit Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame's husband. Apparently, Scooter Libby has a similar plan. It seems to me that this is just short of announcing a business venture on behalf of both of them.
Well, it really does call a lot of things into question. If Karl Rove has to leave, Bush loses his primary liaison to those religious evangelical Christian zealots who have been standing in the way of Harriet Myers for the last week and a half to 2 weeks. Bush cannot pull this out on his own, okay? Yeah. He had Condi Rice try and do something on it, but without Karl Rove, without the guy there that is the bridge between these people, the architect of Bush's little shaky coalition, the whole house of cards could come crumbling down in a matter of months.
Dude, he loses his liaison to political reality, to political thinking, to anything, to strategy, to anything. He loses his liaison to himself.
Well, he's called for the bullpen already. That's why Condi Rice was out there defending Myers yesterday. Condoleezza Rice was in London defending Harriet Myers. He's run out of options. He's got nobody. This team that he has assembled has corrupted itself and eroded from within. Scooter Libby. Andy Card may not turn out to be, now mind you, he is Bush's chief of staff. He may not turn out to be totally blameless in this whole thing either.
Yeah,
he's
we'll
kind
see.
Of the wild card, the bad term, yeah. But he's the one, we don't know what's going to happen to him.
It's a good term if you like puns or whatever you call those, but that's what I was wondering about. The first thing that the impression I got from that Scooter Libby tag on that letter, you know, the out west where you vacation, the aspens will already be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. That somehow was shedding some light on the schism within the administration between the Andy Card group and the Karl Rove group.
Yeah.
That maybe we're seeing some sort of hint as to a separation and one of the clusters going down.
Well,
and
that's entirely possible.
I don't know why I thought that, but that was how it revealed itself to me in my little head. Also, it's important to say that Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, and he was commenting on Fox News Sunday about the leak scandal, and he said, quote, Libby and Rove will be indicted, not for what the original referral was about, but for some combination of disclosing classified information or perhaps failing to be fully candid with federal investigators or with the grand jury, end quote. Now, you know, if Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, certainly if Karl Rove is pushed out of this administration, he will go on to have an incredibly lucrative career in the private sector, creating, you know, conscienceless campaigns for people who are willing to pay. And some of that pay might come out of the public sector. Some of that, this might be a more effective way for him to start putting taxpayers' monies into his pockets.
Well, you know, it's interesting. He may think at this point that his man George Bush is hopelessly compromised, can't go any further with him. Let's start all over. Let me find another George W. Bush.
Borzu Daragahi, our guy in Baghdad, he's a very favorite journalist, is going to call us and let us know what's going on with the Iraqi constitution vote. We're going to get into that. We've got Morning Sedition Radio Theater, and we've got Monday morning to deal with here. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Sedition old-time radio players present this installment of Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
This week on Morning Sedition Radio Theater, PBS's American Masters series presents a Martin Scorsese film, Mark Maron, Can I Get a Ride Home?
So everyone always asked me, you know, what the jokes meant, man. You know, especially the audience was always asking me. But hey, they're just jokes. I wrote the jokes to perform them. I never thought about what they meant. You know, Woody Guthrie was one of my biggest influences, and I used to visit him at the hospital and talk to him when he was dying. You know, I used to talk to him about comedy and stuff. And then I started to realize this guy isn't really very funny. So I went to a different nursing home, and I started visiting Larry Fine from the Three Stooges. I remember when I switched to an electric microphone at the Newport Folk Festival. I was right in the middle of my airline material when they started booing. And I mean, booing.
Judas!
They just didn't want to hear my jokes. You know, they wanted to hear music. I guess I should have known. It was right there on the title, you know, Folk Music Festival. Guess I screwed up.
He came out of New Jersey with just a guitar on his back. And then he got rid of the guitar and started telling jokes and getting booed. It's Martin Scorsese's Mark Maron, Can I Get a Ride Home? On PBS's American Masters.
All right, here we are. Sorry, I drifted off. I was, it's 35 past the hour. Look, the vote in Iraq, Bush hailed the vote as a victory for opponents of terrorism, despite the deaths of six American soldiers on referendum day, five in a bomb blast in Ramadi and one by a bomb in Saklawiya. The deaths bring the total of American military lives lost in Iraq to 1,976. But it does look as though the majority of Iraqi voters said yes to the Constitution when they voted on Saturday. But will the Constitution have a real impact for the people of Iraq, or is it irrelevant as long as the security situation remains so unstable? Our next guest is a staff writer from the L.A. Times, and he joins us on the phone from Baghdad. Please welcome back to the show, Borzu Daragahi. Good morning, Borzu. What is the mood in the streets?
Hey,
Borzu. Are people happy or angry or indifferent?
Well, the city is actually utterly miserable right now just because of a sandstorm. But, you know, I will say with regard to the referendum, you had none of the joy and the celebratory mood that you had during the January 30th elections that listeners may remember. You know, it was a big sort of historic event. It was a really somber mood on referendum day. And people went to the polls almost with a sense of pragmatic duty. You know, this wasn't about, any sense of triumphalism or accomplishment. It was like, wow, we really have to go and vote for this this constitution or vote against it because the future of the country is at stake. And it was also a really divisive issue. Listeners may know that, you know, Sunni Arabs are really against this constitution while Shiites and Kurds are for it. You had a situation where, you know, friends were against friends, neighbors against neighbors, and in some cases spouse against spouse on this issue, really competing visions for the future of Iraq.
So with all that tension and that somber mood and the Sunnis' inability to get the percentage necessary to not vote this through, what do you think? What kind of impact is that going to have on the insurgency, and what kind of impact is it going to have on the Sunni community?
Well, we can theorize all we want, but the bottom line is there's been a lot of political milestones that have been achieved throughout this whole process. And each time there was a lull in violence, and then the violence came back with a rage later on. So it seems like there's a real sort of disconnect between these political milestones and counterinsurgency efforts, getting the insurgents to stop fighting. That said, maybe it's possible that, you know, Sunni Arabs, now that they've voted in droves in this election, maybe they'll feel it incumbent upon themselves to vote again in the December 15th election and, you know, participate. Maybe their numbers will go up a little bit. That doesn't seem to have much to do with the insurgency, though.
Now, Borzu, are the Sunnis that upset about the fact that they were not able to stop this? I mean, they needed a two-thirds majority in three provinces. They apparently were not able to do that. What does that say about their political future inside Iran?
Well, they are a minority, and the question is how gracefully will they deal with that new status? They were the minority before, but they had the power. And you know, it's going to cause a lot of frustration, absolutely. These are people who are used to being on top, and all of a sudden they find themselves at the bottom of the totem pole. And it makes people very angry. It makes people very upset, and that's what's fueling the violence to some extent.
Now, we heard the president here talk about how this is another indication that there's progress being made. It's a first step towards getting a real government in place there. And he seems to think that with that government in place, he's going to start a progressive withdrawal of the troops there. But it doesn't seem to me that Iraq is anywhere near being a secure place for the people that live there.
No, absolutely. You know, even in the provinces where there's not that much of an insurgency, lawlessness and banditry prevail. In addition to that, in parts of the South, the supposedly safe South, according to people that we talk to and visits that we've made down there, really the armed Shiite militias run the show. And if you're not, you know, in good graces with them, you could get, you know, whacked really easily, as happened to a freelancer who was down there, a West American freelance journalist who was down there recently, as well as the stringer for the New York Times. He got killed because he got too close to his story. It just shows the lawlessness that prevails in much of the country.
And some of that lawlessness is on behalf of the police forces themselves, isn't it, Borzu?
Yeah, it seems like that accusation, that allegation, and some evidence is out there that, yes, indeed, there is a real problem with the security forces. We have stories of people being abducted in the middle of the night by people who are in police uniform, driving police vehicles, out way past curfew, so they must have some kind of official portfolio. And then those people are found, those bodies are found 5 days later in a ditch.
Now, what about the talk of, there was a press conference, if you can call it that, or some sort of vaudeville that took place last week. What about this talk that I need it repeated for my own self, that what is the real number or percentage of Iraqi security forces that are actually effectively trained?
It's a very complicated issue. There's about 100 battalions that are stood up. And of those, maybe 35 are able to operate with the U.S. With the U.S. in an advisory role, and maybe between 1 and 3 of those battalions about 600, 700 troops that are able to operate independently. So between 1 and 3. So you've got the bulk of the army, the Iraqi security forces, the Iraqi army at least. It's only operating with the U.S. in the lead. They're operating as backup.
Mm. Now, Borza, we're getting reports here in the States that there's been a strike against insurgents in Ramadi, supposedly killing 70 insurgents, although some people say that up to half of those people could well have been civilians. Ramadi is a Sunni stronghold, no?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a Sunni stronghold. In western Iraq. These operations have been going on all summer and now fall, these operations in western Iraq. It's really hard, I'll be really candid, it's really hard for us to tell what's on in these places. Sometimes there are no embeds there even. They don't even bring embedded journalists there to see what's happening. Did they hit an insurgent stronghold, or did they hit a hospital, as some people sometimes allege, as people out there allege? We have a very difficult time ascertaining the truth in these matters.
Mm-hmm. So, Borzu, did you get to witness that propaganda vaudeville last week, the teleconference between President Bush and U.S. soldiers? And also, have you ever come in contact with that military flak, Master Sergeant Kareem Lombardo, who was posing as a regular soldier in the vaudeville?
Yeah, I haven't come in contact with that. I did read about the incident that you're talking about. I will say that there is a real focus on the part of the military people here on the whole public affairs angle.
Yeah.
A real emphasis on trying to get the message out, trying to get the message that the mission is such and such and so on, and a real frustration on the part of the and this is just a factual statement, real frustration on the part of the U.S. Commanders here that they're not able to get their message out through the Western media. And they've tried all sorts of different things. They've tried embedding journalists. They've tried having press conferences. They've tried giving them access. They tried not giving them access. And there's a real frustration that no matter what they do, the picture that comes out of Iraq is not the picture that they would like. And, it's a real palpable frustration that you sense on their part.
Well, Borzu, what is the message they're trying to send?
That Iraq is a success story.
Well, no, the other people, the other side. What is the message that's being stifled in terms of, these military people on the ground, some military advisors, that the message is that it's not going as well as they would like it to be?
I mean, I think they complain to us all the time, saying that you guys aren't reporting all of the good things that go on in Iraq, and that people are going to school, people are going to work, and the only pictures that come out of Iraq are like car bombings. The only stories that come out are about problems with electricity, problems with infrastructure, problems with reconstruction. There's a lot of good things happening in Iraq. Schools are being built, et cetera, et cetera. To which we reply, I think that's more of a testament to the human spirit that people in a war zone can still, get their kids up in the morning and send them off to school even though they're really worried and so on. The overall picture, however, is a pretty grim one.
Well, thank you, Borzu Daragahi, for joining us. It's always great to talk to you.
Thanks, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Okay, take it easy. Be careful. That was Borzu Daragahi, staff writer in the Baghdad Bureau of the L.A. Times. He's a regular guest on our show. And in a second, we will get into the propagandistic vaudeville that took place last week that was sort of found out by, you know, the media, the regular mainstream media sort of stepped up and called Bush on this stage performance. But what was revealed over the weekend is that one of these soldiers who was presented as just a on-the-ground grunt soldier was actually a woman who, though in the military and though a soldier, was a flack for the military, and that is disturbing. It's 46 past the hour. We'll get into that in a second. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Fifty-one past the hour. It's Monday. Oh man, that's getting better though. I feel it, Riley. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. You know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying, my friends. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. All right. From the Associated Press, Newt Gingrich considers run for president. Translation. Republicans set to announce first loser. All right. From the Associated Press, Rove testifies again in CIA leak probe. Translation. Democrats groan pleasurably, alarming other bus passengers. All right. From the Associated Press, Arkansas mother gives birth to 16th child. Do I go with the right translation or the wrong translation?
The wrong.
Wrong. White trash has litter.
What's the right one?
The right one. Southern woman becomes conservative pick for Supreme Court. It's much funner to be wrong. You know, they take offense to that white trash label. That's, from what I understand, that's a bad thing to say about people. Here we go, Riley.
We are, man.
Huh?
We are what we are.
Oh.
Speak for yourself, trash man. All right, here we go. You know what? That is true, and that's very deep, Kayla. Thank you for sharing that. We are what we are. That's very deep. That's,
you bastard.
You're a deep guy, man. I got to stop to reflect a little bit just because you got me going with the
I'm like Buddha.
What you are. Yeah, if you're Buddha, we're all in trouble. What am I looking at here? The media is finally doing its job, kind of, Riley. Last week, many mainstream media outlets slammed the president for staging and rehearsing a White House video link-up with Iraq that used U.S. soldiers as pawns to make the Iraq war strategy seem like it is the right thing. This is no surprise. These guys stage everything. The fact that the media is actually calling him on it is good. Maybe they'll stop being his outlet of illusion presented as reality to the people of this country, because that illusion is certainly breaking up a bit. This propagandistic vaudeville that happened last week is made even worse by the fact that one of the soldiers who presented herself as just a soldier was actually a flack for the military. That's her job, is to disperse talking points. And, you know, in the interaction between her and Bush, you can hear that this is certainly the farthest thing from a conversation I've ever heard. I know, because I read stuff and act like I'm talking sometimes. And this woman is reading something and acting like she's talking. Can we hear that there, Kayla?
Let me ask you about the progress. Most of you have been there for nearly a year, as I understand it. And is it possible to give us a sense, a kind of a calibration of what life was like when you first got there and what it's like today?
That's the setup.
Mr. President, Master Lombardo will answer this question.
Good morning, Mr. President. I'm Master Sergeant Corinne Lombardo with the Headquarters 42nd Infantry Division and Task Force Liberty from Scotia, New York. First, I'd like to say this is a pleasure to speak with you again. We had the honor of your visit to New York City on November 11th in 2001 when you recognized our Rainbow Soldiers for their recovery and rescue efforts at Ground Zero.
Were you there?
We began our fight against terrorism.
This is so conversational, the way she's handling this.
And we're proud to continue it here in north central Iraq. I can tell you over the past 10 months, we've seen a tremendous increase in the capabilities and the confidences of our Iraqi security force partners.
If she's not reading, she's a robot.
We're working side by side, training and equipping 18 Iraqi Army battalions. Since we began our partnership, they have improved greatly. And they continue to develop and grow into sustainable forces.
Didn't they improve greatly.
Over the next month, we anticipate seeing at least one-third of those Iraqi forces conducting independent operations.
Yeah, that's important. And the American people got to know it. And I appreciate you bringing us that up, Sergeant Major.
Yeah, for you, that was just
what the progress is like.
Shooting from the hip there and bringing that up.
You know, we've got a measurement system.
Together with our coalition forces, we've captured over 50 terrorists,
got a little
as well
as there.
Detained thousands of others that have ties to the insurgency. And I believe it is these accomplishments and the numerous accomplishments from our task force provide a safe and secure environment for the referendum vote.
How could anybody think that she was just talking? I don't even understand how any... All right, look, but he could have identified her as a media representative of the military. Well, he should have just identified her that, but he chose to push her off as a regular soldier to deceive whatever is left of this public that actually believes that crap. Who's going to watch that? Are there actually people in this country that would sit there and listen to that and assume it's a conversation of some kind?
See, this is something that the Bush people have been trying to deal with since way back when all of those right-wing talk show hosts went to Iraq. Borzu just talked about it as well. The whole notion that there's some good news somewhere in Iraq that the media simply is not covering. That's what this is in response to. And that's why they have the curious specter of an event planner for the Army talking to the president as if she's on the front lines doing something.
Right, but it seems to me that the talk of schools functioning and, you know, some elements of society working better, we've discussed that, you know, out of 2,000 projects that needed to get done on the small scale, about 1,700 are being done in Iraq. That's all well and good. But on a media level, it's really no different than, baby holes. Is it?
Well, it's not any different than baby holding, but they want the propaganda to take hold with the American public.
Well, in a second, we're going to talk about Judith Miller's at least journalistic romance with Scooter Libby and some undisclosed source that she just couldn't remember. What a Republican tactic that is. 57 past Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Six past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Good morning. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. And in this studio, as we sit right now, there are just banners plastered all over the place with the new Air America Radio logo. That might mean they're going to actually do some advertising. I don't know. But maybe this logo will find its way into the world of New York City where we broadcast from and actually raise the awareness of Air America's new form. That's us. Yeah. So I like the new logo. It's kind of Helfiger-ish, isn't it? Am I wrong? Doesn't it look like Tommy Hilfiger?
Yes, it does look like that.
It does look a little, actually.
Yeah, it's all right. It's okay. What else is going on?
I want to give a special shout-out, Mark, to Henry, the Time Warner cable man, who came and fixed my cable on Friday afternoon.
For those of you just tuning in, that's Don Pushman, our producer. Yeah. Don Pushman. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Brendon, the other producer,
is
not around.
Yeah, Brendon. Yeah. Don Pushman.
But Henry came to fix my cable on Friday afternoon. He walks in the door and he says, "You're Dan Pashman from Morning's Edition."
Yeah.
And he's a big fan of the show. So hello to Henry.
So did he give you a deal on the cable or what?
Yeah, free cable.
As soon as I told everyone else that this had happened, they were like, "So you got free something, right?" And I didn't think to ask, and he didn't offer.
Well, that's very nice because you were so excited and stunned that you could now add the a little something to the myth of Pashman.
Right. I mean,
the Pashman myth grows.
I didn't want to use my friendship with you, Mark and Mark, you guys, you know, for too much. You know, I didn't want to.
Oh.
That friendship is worth a lot in New York City. That's big time.
And yeah. Kayla, of course, this weekend shaving his nether regions and watching football. That's great.
And I saw a good movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What movie?
The Squid and the Whale.
I heard that was good.
It was awesome.
We had talked to Jeff Daniels, but he played guitar, and then we didn't have him back. And it was good. It was good. But I don't
so
know
why didn't we have him back?
Well, now I regret that maybe we should have had him back for The Squid and the Whale because I've heard good things about that film.
Yeah.
John Crimmings, Boy Genius. What were you doing this weekend?
You turn the mic on.
The brother was in town.
I also saw Squid and the Whale.
And did you like it?
Yeah, I liked it a lot.
And where's the little Goliath, the genius? Where's he at?
He's waiting for our next guest outside.
Oh, he is? So then I guess we should do some news. Now, what's new guy's name that's going to replace Kayla?
Trent.
Trent, it's nice to have you on board. I've seen you around.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Yeah.
It's
going to be hard to follow Kayla, you know?
Not that hard, though.
Yeah.
After this weekend, you know, it's a little, the weekend news is kind of hard to follow.
Kayla leaves, I'd like to see your panic face. You know,
we'll work on it.
Okay, thanks, man. Oh, good, good. All right, so as we spoke of earlier, yesterday in an article in the New York Times written by Judith Miller about Judith Miller and her testimony before the grand jury, suggests a couple of things. One, that she is still and may always will be a codependent Republican stooge. And the other, it just questions her journalist integrity, if she has any. In the piece, she recollects her testimony before Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury last week on October 12th and before that on September 30th, where she talked about her, like, one of several meetings and conversations with Scooter Libby, that's Vice President Cheney's chief of staff. The big problem with this whole thing is that when it comes right down to it, here's what happens. So Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, gives her permission to let herself out of jail and go ahead and talk about him.
Yeah, right? Permission, by the way, that his lawyer says he gave a year ago.
He gave a year ago, but I can't. The nuances of this thing are driving me nuts. The bottom line is she makes an agreement with Fitzgerald, the grand jury prosecutor, to only talk about Libby, okay? And when asked in reference to the newly uncovered notebooks of hers that had the name, quote, Valerie Flame, unquote, written on top of one of the pages, these notebooks revealed interaction between Miller and Libby weeks before it was assumed that they had started talking, weeks before Joe Wilson's op-ed appeared in the Times saying that the Yellowcake Uranium Niger deal was bogus and it was a primary sort of, pillar of the Iraq's group propaganda campaign to sell the public on the war in Iraq. All right, all that's there. So when asked by Fitzgerald if she could recall discussing the Wilson Flame connection with other sources, she said she had discussed but could not recall any name or conversation that occurred. Could not recall. Wasn't in the notebook, apparently not in the brain. So the big question is, who's she hiding? What's the other source? Why is she able to just say, I don't remember, and get off like that? Does Fitzgerald know something? Was a deal cut with Judith Miller that enables her to go ahead and say this? And maybe Fitzgerald knows something and she knows something, but she's not talking about that either.
Well, the question I would think as a journalist that Judith Miller would have is, why is this administration going to such lengths? And remember, she had several conversations with Libby about this. If you take everything else aside, why were they trying to savage Joe Wilson? Technically speaking, that's news enough for a reporter to write a story about, separate and apart from everything else.
That's a good issue you bring up, Riley. If she's such a great reporter, where's her Joe Wilson notes?
Yeah, how come she didn't talk to Joe Wilson, apparently, about any of this? Was he inaccessible? He had written an op-ed for her newspaper in July of 2003. If she had all this information, if she started to put two and two together here, she talked to, she admits she talked to Libby on June 23rd. June 23rd to July 6th is what, about two weeks or so?
Yeah.
So somewhere in there. So why didn't it dawn on her, wait a minute, here comes Wilson with this savaging of the information that Bush used to go to war. Why not talk to him?
That's a great point, and that's something I haven't heard talked about. If she has any integrity, or she is a real journalist, and she wasn't a codependent Republican stooge carrying water for this administration in their attempt to propagandize the Iraq War to all of us, which they did successfully because of, in part, her, and which turned out to be just a load of crap in the end. So why didn't she talk to Joe Wilson? That's a good question. And given that Libby was her main source and that Libby was pressed from the inside to let her testify, in whether he says he did it a year ago or not, or whether his lawyer says he did it a year ago or not. They also say that he might not have voluntarily just said to do that. Am I wrong?
Well, what happens here, again, is a matter of Judith Miller's interpretation of what Libby's lawyer said. Libby's lawyer said, look, we gave her permission to go ahead and talk because the sense was, I guess, that she would do nothing that would contradict what Libby was saying at the time.
Yeah, and the bottom line is that she has been the editor of the New York Times. This guy, what's his name, James Keller? Is that his name? One of them?
Yeah, that's Bill Keller, the executive editor.
I mean, these people have had to apologize for her work in the past. 5 out of 6 articles that were co-written by her leading up to the Iraq War about from intelligence on the ground about weapons was questionable. She admits to getting it wrong because she believed sources that were non-believable, that were not credible. Where's the research? Where is the vetting of sources? All right, so she can't just dismiss that. It becomes clear in the timing of the Iraq group's the Iraq group, who, as you know or don't know, was comprised of Carl Rove, Karen Hughes, Mary Matlin, James Wilkinson, Nicholas Calio, Condi Rice, Stephen Hadley, and Scooter Libby. It was brought together by Andrew Card specifically to put propaganda together to sell the public on the weapons of mass destruction. Her articles were used in speeches by Dick Cheney. She has been an operative of this sort of an appendage of the Iraq group since its inception, and most of her articles coincide with their propaganda efforts. Now, the bottom line is that who could she be hiding? Was she coached to forget? Did someone tell her, just say you don't remember? That's source she could now be protecting, I think, is Dick Cheney. That's what I think. I think he was the guy. He was at the CIA every other day leading up to the war, leading up to getting the information about the yellow cake out of George Tenet, who has since taken the fall for that. And they've gutted the CIA entirely because of this debacle, which might have been intentional. And now most intelligence operations are done in-house. They're done in the Pentagon.
Well, you know, people ought to focus for a moment on the fall of 2003. That was when the Washington Post identified, quote, 2 top White House officials who were the people that disclosed Valerie Plame's identity to at least 6 journalists working in Washington. Judith Miller was asked if she was one of them. She denied it. Now, the speculation has been that the 2 senior White House officials were Libby and Rove. That's not necessarily the case. You may be right. Maybe one of them was Dick Cheney. There's no record of Judith Miller ever having spoken to Karl Rove about this. Who was the second administration official? Take a guess.
Yeah. Well, here you go. The bottom line is that conservatives like William Kristol over the Weekly Standard are saying that it's pretty clear that Rove and Carl and Scooter Libby will be indicted, and there has been speculation that they will resign, both of them, or take leaves of absence to defend themselves or maybe go into business together. And the bottom line about the New York Times is, by enabling Judith Miller to determine how she will conduct her defense, including her saying that she couldn't recall the original source of her first encountering the name of Valerie Plame, the New York Times is continuing to enable her to cover up possibly a second leak source and thus carry water for this corrupt administration. They are enabling her to do that because their own standards are laxed, or they're frightened, or they just don't have it together. So the criticism of them being a liberal paper, this is a liberal newspaper perhaps, but they are enabling somebody to continue to carry water for the neocon death cult without, you know, taking action in-house to stop her. They've tried to stop her before. She seems, apparently she is so important to that organization that they couldn't get rid of her because she just ran roughshod over everybody.
That was a great statement. So important they couldn't get rid of her. No, you're fired was not in their vocabulary when it came to Judith Miller. Maybe now, though. You never know.
We'll see. It's 16 past the hour. We're going to get into a little bit of the continuing propaganda campaign. Like this whole fictional reality, this hyper-reality that the Bush administration has fought so hard to maintain is really starting to chip away because the mainstream media is starting to chip. And now, you know, Armstrong Williams, this is interesting. There's some action in the Senate to bring the Department of Education to answer for the fact that he was being paid to be a propagandist, but he might not have delivered the propaganda.
So he didn't bring the goods?
He didn't deliver the propaganda.
Armstrong didn't bring the noise?
So Lautenberg and Kennedy want to investigate him for that. 17 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
It's 22 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. It is Monday morning. I hope you're doing all right. I feel all right, I guess. I don't know. I'm trying. little Goliath, you all right, buddy? You don't have to get on the mic right now. We'll put you on later. I want you to get your thoughts together, you know. I know you had two things to do this morning. It took a lot out of you. is that mean? Is it mean? Why am I mean sometimes? Because I'm uncomfortable. You know, I like to churn. Because I'm uncomfortable and I feel like I'm in the hallway waiting for something to happen, right? I would rather be miserable than uncomfortable. So I take actions to make myself miserable as opposed to just living with discomfort. Do you understand what I'm saying? What I'm saying is I've not stopped eating for 3 days, okay? And I have not exercised in about 5 days. You know what that makes me? Crazy, all right? I don't know if it's just me. I don't know if it's important. Maybe someone out there relates to this. The difference between discomfort, which is natural when you're in a situation that you're not clear what's going to happen, and misery is, how can I make that situation worse so I can have some control over the situation? I know. Let me just keep eating until I hate myself. Then I know exactly what's going on. I'm no longer uncomfortable. I am sick of me. Do you understand how that works, Riley?
Not at all, but what did you eat?
You know, whatever's around, man. Ice cream, plowing through the ice
no
cream.
No meat, though.
Good
huh?
stuff. I didn't. And, you know, Jim Earle and his lovely lady friend, Heather, actually came out to Queens to scope out the area because we're thinking about moving out there, and I took him out to Jackson Diner and in Jackson Heights there to have some Indian food. So we plowed through an Indian buffet. Of course, you know, I went through three plates as they eating at normal speed went through one and then had two cups of rice pudding. So I'm looking forward to becoming a heavy person.
You haven't become one yet despite having eaten for 3 days.
Oh, that's all I was looking for. Let's go on for the news.
See, I know how to make you comfortable.
I got what I wanted, man. Join Mark Maron and Mark Riley for Fishing for Compliments. Man, I don't know about my haircut. Do you think it looks great? Yeah, I got one. Let me reel that baby in. All right, so let's talk about Armstrong Williams. First, refresh my memory, Riley. He was, he was nailed by the GAO. Right,
yes.
By the Government Accountability Office, has concluded that the Department of Education was involved in illegal covert propaganda by hiring Republican commentator Armstrong Williams to disseminate information about the No Child Left Behind Act.
Right. Yes? To the tune of $250,000 that went through a public relations firm. See, what they did was filter it. So it looked like it wasn't a direct payment. But the Education Department gave that $250,000 to a company called Ketchum Public Relations, who in turn gave it to Armstrong to go out and proselytize in favor of No Child Left Behind through commentaries, through his broadcast, through written stuff. And now there are questions about whether he actually did the work.
That's hilarious to me. So in response this is Senator Frank Lautenberg's request for a criminal investigation into questions about whether right-wing propagandist commentator Armstrong Williams actually did the propaganda he was paid to do. The Education Department has contacted the U.S. Attorney's Office, right? Mm-hmm. So Lautenberg and Ted Kennedy wrote a letter to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez stating that questions of fraud remain and the issue be investigated. I just think it's hilarious to me that they've been nailed for illegal covert propaganda. And now Democratic senators are actually saying, you know what, but he didn't engage in that propaganda and he got paid for being a propagandist. And now where's that money and where was the work done? Now he's in trouble again.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because the previous education secretary, Rod Paige, who made these deals, defended Armstrong Williams despite it having been found that he, you know, was in fact a propagandist. The new education secretary, Margaret Spellings, does not seem to be quite as supportive. So my guess is somebody may be asking for a refund sometime soon.
I just, you know, I can't get it out of my head, Riley, the disconnect between our perception as individuals and what is really happening in the world is all funneled or channeled through the TV or media outlets. You can get information from wherever you want. There's no, from wherever you want. There's no barometer that ensures any sort of integrity whatsoever. It seems to me that the only thing you can be sure of barely is that I'm holding this cup right now.
Well, look, there isn't that big of a difference between Armstrong Williams, Corinne Lombardo, the master sergeant we were just talking about, the White House Iraq group. They are all propagandists. That's what they were formed to do. That's what they were doing on behalf of this administration. Now, why does an administration need a propagandist? That's the question we should be asking ourselves. If they had an identifiable record of accomplishment, they wouldn't need Armstrong Williams or Corinne Lombardo or any Mary Matlin or all any of the rest of these people.
Well, they need a propagandist is because they know that people are suckers because we don't have time. Who the hell has the time to figure out what the hell the truth is? I look at some of these blogs and I'm like, does this person ever leave the house? Do they sit there writing all day long? They do it, and I thank them for it, but most people just want to get a little packet of information they can stick in their dumb heads to regurgitate later. Whether it's true or false doesn't matter. Whether it fits their ideology or not matters, and that's the whole thing. It doesn't matter if it's true.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's true, and then some cases... Well, never mind about the bloggers.
So it's we got Morning Remembrance coming up. We got Peter Mansu, who's written a book. He's the son of a priest and a nun. That should be interesting. 27 past, Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We got Morning Remembrance just around the corner, folks. You know, Morning Remembrance with Mort Mortensen.
Oh, him,
aka Jim Earl.
Him,
aka the guy I had brunch with yesterday. How do you like that? We actually spent a little time out of the studio together. I'm sure we'll have something to say about that that will hurt my feelings later. Our next guest is the son of a Catholic priest and a nun, and his new book, Vows, the story of a priest, a nun, and their son, explains what it was like growing up in a household that was ostracized by the Catholic Church, but still determined never to let the church go. He's also editor of the website killingthebuddha.com, and he'll be signing copies of his book tonight in New York at McNally Robinson, 50 Prince Street at 7:30 p.m. Please welcome Peter Manso to the show this morning. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So your father was a priest, your mom was a nun. I guess my first question is, you okay, buddy?
I'm doing all right. Much better now, thanks.
After the book writing? You vented?
All my demons out, yeah. I should say that my father is still technically a Catholic priest. My mother left the convent, but my father, as a matter of principle, has refused to resign his ordination for about 40 years.
Now, despite what the church is saying, or...
Yeah, well, the church recognizes him as a Catholic priest. He's officially a Catholic priest under censure, a kind of suspension. But they haven't gone so far as to bring the axe down on him yet.
So how did this, if I might ask, how did the relationship between your parents start?
Well, my parents met at a time of great change in the Catholic Church. It was the 60s. They were involved in the civil rights movement in Boston. And they saw the world changing as well as their church. It was right after the Second Vatican Council, which, as you may know, changed the church in ways that they hadn't seen in hundreds of years. So with that, having experienced that, having witnessed it, they hoped that their church might eventually change the policy of celibacy. They decided to go ahead and get married as a way of pushing that along. They thought the church would catch up with them eventually, but unfortunately they've been disappointed.
So they justified their union as a political action.
Basically, and a spiritual action. They felt that the church had gone in the wrong direction, and they wanted to get it back to its original intention.
But did they at least give a little credence to the fact that they were in love with each other?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Now, after they were ostracized by the church, why do you think it was that they managed to stay with it, that they still wanted to be devout Catholics?
Oh, I don't think they had a choice. I mean, I think we have to remember that 50 years ago, it was an entirely different world for Catholics. I mean, you grew up in Catholic Boston. You can't imagine being something different. My father told me that when JFK was assassinated and he saw people crying on the streets, when he realized they were not Catholic, he thought, why are they crying?
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is a Catholic thing. And so to to be not Catholic is something that is beyond the realm of possibility for them, really. And it's an essential factor of their identity.
Did it trouble you as you came up and began to understand what had happened? Did you ever question him and say, gee, why are you still doing this? Or did you sort of, were you raised in it to the point where you didn't question?
Oh, all the time we questioned. It caused a lot of problems within our family that my father, his mission in life was to change the church, and it created a lot of tension between how much time do you spend on the mission and how much time do you spend in the home. And I think that's probably a problem that the families of a lot of true believers and whatever you believe probably have.
Was there any weird yelling at your mom, like, you're not even a nun anymore? Any of that?
Not quite like that, but there was some tension about how much we did, the children, my brother and sister and I, did or did not pay attention at church. And that caused some trouble.
Did you eventually, are you still a practicing and believing Catholic yourself?
This will sound like a strange answer, but I am neither practicing nor believing, but I still think of myself as a Catholic.
I understand that. I'm a Jew, and I neither practice nor believe. But when did that happen? I mean, what was it that sort of shattered your conception of what the religion was supposed to be about?
Well, it's come and gone, I think. I had a pretty... I still think of myself as a fairly religious person. I studied religion in college, and while I was in college, I even flirted with the idea of becoming a Catholic monk. I was fascinated by the life, had romantic notions about it, I think. And eventually I realized that, in fact, I was trying to be something that I wasn't.
Sure.
And so I think as I just grew up, I grew out of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spent a trial week, in a monastery near where you went to college, is that right?
I spent a bit more time than that. I went several times, spoke with the vocation director there, and really pursued the idea of becoming a monk.
Now, what was that like? I mean, why did you decide finally not to do it?
Well, I love being there, honestly. I love the life, and the men who live there were wonderful. They're very kind to me and very welcoming.
Were your parents supportive?
I mainly kept it from them.
You didn't tell them?
I told them where I was going. I didn't tell them why. I was writing a novel about nuns and living in the 14th century, and I thought that I could get away with explaining this all as research, you know. And people believed me, but mainly I was going to investigate the life for myself. But ultimately, as I said, it was just... you can only lie to yourself for so long, I guess, about what you're not.
That's interesting. Most kids, you know, hide their drug use or their strange relationships from their parents. You're hiding the desire to be a monk.
Well, the Catholic monasticism as it exists today is entirely counter to the kind of faith my parents are trying to create. It's a throwback, basically, and they're trying to bring the church into the 21st century, and I was trying to go back to the 14th.
Wow.
So you were really rebelling. With your kind of parents who were progressive Catholics, going back to the 14th century is about as bad as you can get. Now, we had a guest on who was actually sexually abused by a priest and actually grew up, processed this, went public with it, is married, has a child, and is bringing them up Catholic in the church. Now, what is it about Catholicism, from your point of view, that how does it still function for somebody like you and for somebody like him? Obviously, we can't speak for him, but what kind of spiritual mojo spell does Catholicism have on somebody and why?
As I see it, it provides such a thorough and pervasive vocabulary of belief. You learn to think about God, and you learn to think about believing in, on certain terms, and it becomes impossible without great work to think on new terms. It's like it's as hard as it is to learn a new language. That's how hard it is to leave the language of Catholicism behind.
Wow! So it infuses every part of your brain, the rational brain, the mystical brain, and the magical thinking and the belief side, to the point where I guess. But you weren't brought up in a Latin situation either, in terms of the mass being in Latin, were you?
No. It's we weren't that kind of traditional return to Latin Catholics.
It's interesting. So even with a fairly progressive background in the Catholic Church, that vocabulary still infuses your entire being.
Well, I think that's true of all faith traditions. You learn the ways of thinking of things, and it's hard to leave it behind. I got an email the other day from a woman who was raised as a Buddhist by Italian-American parents. Mm. And she later subversively explored her Italian Catholic heritage and didn't want to tell her Buddhist parents because she had been so thoroughly... a part of this world and this way of thinking about things.
It's weird because I was not brought up with any, you know, I was brought up Jewish, but not I was not given, I guess, the gift or the curse of having a belief. I was not taught how to believe in God. But you're saying that one of the fundamental teachings, even in a progressive Catholic household, was how to believe in God.
Just in turn, I mean, I think that faith has a lot to do with imagination, which is not to say that it's entirely made up. I mean, it's more complicated than being made up. But it has enough to do with the imagination that it does infect the way you think about all other things. It provides you with a faith vocabulary. Is that?
Mm. You know, it's interesting because in some parts of the world, people are deserting the Catholic Church for evangelical Christianity. If you go to the Caribbean, for example, in Dominican Republic and places like that, how do you deal with that? And what do your parents, do they think that that is something that the Church ought to be concerned about?
No, I think my father, I should say, in addition to being a radical Catholic, is a fairly radical Christian in the sense that he believes that all the Christian churches should be one. And so he thinks a crossover between Catholicism and evangelicals is a good thing. But that said, I do think that the reason why that's happening is because the evangelical church is providing certain things that the Catholic church is not. I think that the Catholic Church has failed a lot of people in a lot of parts of the world. It just hasn't provided a compelling narrative anymore.
Right. There's a simplicity of message to modern evangelical Christianity mm-hmm. that is very appealing to people because it doesn't require the archetypes or the language of Catholicism, and it is devoid of the history of Catholicism. I guess apparently many of the mega churches here in America are devoid of Christ in some ways in terms of the narrative that they're putting forth. Their church more of a self-affirmation situation. Now, what is the, in your eyes, or in being that, by the way, we're talking to Peter Manso, who is the author of Vows, the story of a priest, a nun, and their son, in terms of being brought up in this incredibly, you know, rebellious and progressive Catholic environment, where do you see the Catholic Church going?
Well, I think the Catholic Church always changes. It thinks of itself as this eternal, unchanging institution, but there's always change, and it changes forward and changes back. In the 60s, when my parents met, they saw a moment of great progress, and it has since rolled back. I think it can only roll back so far before it starts to go in the other direction again. So I think we'll start to see that.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, I'm not even just talking about Catholicism. I'm talking about the general move in religion to be regressive in that way. What did your folks feel about the horrendous sexual scandal that came upon the church in the last few years?
Oh, they were heartbroken by it. I mean, for a few reasons. My father went to St. John's Seminary in Boston, which is where a number of the most horrendous priest abusers went. They were classmates of his. He knew them in seminaries. Paul Shanley, John Gagan.
Oh, he was the real devil, that Shanley cat.
Yeah,
yeah, and my father knew him in the 60s, and they were both sort of radical street priests in Boston. And he tells me that had you asked anyone, any priest in Boston in the 60s, who was a good priest, who was going to change the world, they would have said Paul Shanley.
Yeah.
Because he was, in addition to doing what he eventually did, he was a real radical, and he was down in it. So they were heartbroken on that front. They had other friends who were implicated as well. But also, as I learned as I was writing the book, I didn't know this before I began, but my mother had been abused by a priest.
Mm.
And in fact, she had a case against the church. It reached the courts in Massachusetts. So they were devastated on any number of ways. But not only because of that personal connection to it, just by being Catholics.
Right.
They felt that it was a wound to the family.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're married. You have a child?
I do.
Now, your child is not being raised Catholic. Why not?
She will not be, no. I'm very grateful for my Catholic upbringing. I think it's provided me with a lot in terms of just connecting to history and understanding where I come from. But it's not something I want to inflict upon her. I think that, if I've learned anything from my parents' stories, that part of living a faithful life is just being open to possibility and seeing where life takes you. So that's what my wife and I are going to do with our daughter.
Well, that's a nice message to end on. Peter Manso, the book is Vows, a story of a priest, a nun, and their son. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with the book.
Thanks so much.
All right, it's 46 past the hour. We'll be back with Morning Remembrance. Hang out.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Free golf? Free golf?
past the hour. Did you hear that? 51 past the hour, I said. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hey.
It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. You know, unfortunately, folks, it's that time of week again where we here at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh, boy. Monday, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Monday. Only 2 days before hump day.
Yeah, it is.
Hump day. Midweek. Wednesday.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Here we go.
Okay, good. Let's get on with it.
Arthur Seldon. Was that an S? Yeah. Arthur Seldon, British economist.
Yeah.
Arthur Seldon, whose theories inspired the right-wing economic policies of Margaret Thatcher, has died of a brain aneurysm after years of being affectionately pummeled on the head with the Prime Minister's purse.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Thatcher did that a lot.
Yeah.
After serving in World War II, the young Seldon began his career by doing economic research for the beer industry. It was during a particularly intense night of research that he first came up with the idea of school vouchers for kegs of Guinness.
Yeah.
Later, as co-founder of the Institute of Economic Affairs, Seldon authored more than 28 books and 230 articles, all dedicated to screwing over the poor. It was the Thatcher economics.
Yeah, that's right. I know. I remember that.
You remember that?
Yeah, sure.
Family members can console themselves with the thought that Seldon is now up in heaven, trickling down all over us.
Oh, boy.
Our next person, Tobin Armstrong.
Yeah.
Texas cattle rancher.
Oh, one of those guys.
Yeah. Tobin Armstrong, one of the men most responsible for helping generations of Americans consume dangerous amounts of growth hormones, antibiotics, and bovine grease, is now dead meat.
Dead meat.
This is a cattle term.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Armstrong would regularly discuss world issues at his 50,000-acre ranch with the likes of Dick Cheney and former President George Bush Sr., while George Jr. would amuse himself by tipping over cows. Armstrong's grandfather was a Texas Ranger, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, who became famous for capturing the notorious outlaw John Wesley Hardin.
Mm.
Hardin was reportedly so mean, he once shot a man for snoring while he was shooting a man for snoring.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's mean.
It's really mean.
Yeah. You all right?
Yeah, you got a tissue?
Yeah, why don't you blow your nose or something, because it sounds like it's starting to run.
Yeah.
Wow. What is that, a cardboard tissue? What is going on with that?
Air America can't afford the quality stuff.
Maybe she used one of these banners with the new logo on it.
Is that what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, Tobin's wife, Ann, once served as an advisor to Presidents Nixon and Ford.
Hmm.
Her most lasting piece of advice? Destroy the tapes and eat more beef. Armstrong requested his body be hung upside down in a blood-splattered stainless steel chamber. Symbolically stunned with a retractable metal rod slammed into his forehead, and still squirming, sent down a conveyor belt to have his tail cut, belly ripped, and hide pulled. While a sleep-deprived worker falls into the rendering vat beside him.
That is quite a funeral.
Yeah,
sure is.
Wow, it's original. It's exciting. Takes it to a whole new level.
See, he was an entrepreneur. He thought outside the box.
Yeah, and I think that's terrific. So, how you doing? You all right?
I got a lot of allergies and things getting in my eyes. You know, it's moving. It's moving time. I'm trying to move to a new place and everything, and all the dust is just coming up.
That's too bad.
give me some problems with that.
All right. Well, I appreciate you being here.
How you doing?
I'm all right, man. So why don't we trickle out of the character so we can talk to Jim as Jim?
Uh-oh.
Oh, he just did a lot in smalls.
Yeah.
So, buddy.
I am out of character.
Very good.
So we had a good time, Riley. We miss you, man. We went and got Indian food down at Jackson Diner, Jim Earl and I.
Yeah, I heard.
We miss you. Thanks for showing up, by the way.
Mainly legumes, I trust.
We waited for you for a half hour.
Yeah, under the train?
I told him the elevator? I told him you were coming.
Oh.
Yeah.
He lied.
I didn't call you.
I wasn't thinking about coming.
Wait, no. How great is that, though, just to have buffet? Isn't it great? Don't you wish every day could be a buffet?
Buffets are great.
I'm serious, man. If I had my choice, if I had the lack of control that I wish I had, I would sit at a buffet all day and just get fat.
Indian buffet or just buffet?
I'd mix it up. You know what I mean? There should just be a buffet street.
Buffets are kind of dangerous, Mark, with all the stuff hanging around there and getting lukewarm and... butter fats.
We were there early, though. Yeah, so you think you're going to move to Astoria? You think that's the deal?
Possibly either that or Park Slope.
Well, I would go Park Slope if you had the choice, I guess. Wouldn't you? No, maybe, you know, I don't want to alienate. You know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stay loyal to Astoria because personally, as you saw, I took you around my lovely neighborhood. Yeah. I showed you places. I introduced you to some people, you know, because when I walk down the streets, there are people waving me, hey, Mr. Mailman, you know, that kind of stuff.
Hey, you're not the mailman.
No, I know, but I wave to the mailman. Oh. I say, hey, Mr. Mailman, and they go, there's that guy that says the weird things, and they wave at me back, and they move on.
So you... See, there are tons of stores all over those streets.
Yes, there's Steinway Street is full of stores that no one would ever want to go into.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's one of the big draws, is to have stores. I thought this was going to go someplace.
We should take notes beforehand, maybe.
I thought you were just going to say something to hurt my feelings, and then I'd say something to hurt yours.
I'm not going
to
hurt your feelings.
See what happened? See, we broke the fourth wall, and we're friends now. It's 57 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. When we come back, we're going to talk about Iraq. And we're going to talk to James Wolcott. Stay with us. Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Woohoo. Oh, boy. How you doing, people? What an amazing Monday morning this has been. I've never felt happier in my life. You, Riley?
Is this like Z1190?
Yeah, the sun's coming up.
You sounded pretty DJ-ish this morning now.
I just felt like doing that. What's going on?
The platters that matter.
That's right, baby. We'll be spinning them all day long, so hang out. We're having a good time.
Yay.
I don't know what's going on. Sometimes I hear myself in my head. I'm like, wow, let's change it up a little bit. Look, there's people just tuning in. You know, It's just coming up at 10 past the hour. It's 7 past the hour, whatever. People are getting up. Good morning to you people. I hope you have a nice Monday. Your weekend was fine. You had a good time, Riley?
Mm-hmm.
You told me you spent a couple of days watching someone put something up in your bathroom.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It was very well done.
That sounds riveting.
Yeah, it was. It included several rivets, apparently, because they were making a whole bunch of noise up in there.
I did lots of comedy Friday and Saturday. I cooked a vat of red chili from fresh chilies. Well, not from fresh chilies, but from dried red chilies from New Mexico. I'm thinking about making some enchiladas tomorrow. You know why? Because I can't stop eating. All right, but that is not an issue. Let's not talk about that. There's important things at hand. Pashman, your team lost yesterday. Is that why you're dismal and miserable and only mildly optimistic as opposed to the insanely manic optimism you have generally?
It was a tough loss for the Giants yesterday, it's true.
Yeah, and why was that? Because, you know, I tried to watch some football. I went to watch 60 Minutes, but football was on, so I said, well, maybe this is what I should be watching.
Right.
And it didn't work. I didn't lock in. I didn't know. I like it when they do something wrong and the umpire or the referee speaks and he sounds loud. I thought it would be interesting.
You like penalties.
Right.
What?
You like penalties.
Well, no, I just like every time it happens, I'm wondering, is that guy really talking or is there some guy lip syncing for him? Because I can never see a mic, but it seems to be that guy.
He does have a mic on him. It's the wonders of modern technology.
I would love to do stand-up like that in a football arena. I like the slight delay.
Illegal procedure number 76. And folks, what's the deal with airplane food?
Yeah. Why do people always use airplane food? Is it? No one ever talks about that anymore. You know why? Because they don't feed you anymore.
Good point.
All right, so what's the matter with the Giants?
It's a game that they definitely could have won, probably should have won, and didn't win, even in spite of a last-minute comeback that fell short.
Yeah, and Chris, what's your problem?
Hey, I also like the Giants, but I feel pretty good.
Yeah, all right. Ugh. Yesterday, in an article in the New York Times written by Judith Miller about Judith Miller, trying to get Judith Miller off the hook and make Judith Miller seem like a good person and a reasonable journalist, there was a lot of questions that were raised that I could tell you right now, Riley. In the piece, she recollects her testimony before Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury last week on October 12th and before that on September 30th. What we learn is it is a recollection of not being able to recollect the very source that was that she was said to be protecting when she chose jail over testifying. Now, what's going on here is that Scooter Libby has been the source. He okayed her to talk about him as a source. But what is implied here in this testimony over the last couple of days, outside of the three or four conversations she had with Scooter Libby, one of them being long before anyone assumed they were talking about Valerie Flame, which was what was written on one of the pages of her notebook, is that these notebooks revealed this interaction that took place weeks before Joe Wilson put his op-ed in the Time. But when asked by Fitzgerald if she could recall discussing the Wilson plane connection with other sources, she said she could, but she could not recall any names or conversations that occurred, which is ridiculous. She has notes, but if they're not on the notes, she can't remember. And she's obviously protecting something or somebody. I'm thinking maybe another source. Unfortunately, it was a condition of her testimony that she could only talk about Libby. And I'm thinking it might have been Cheney. I think that Libby told her to go ahead and use the I can't recall, trick.
Well, you know what? If you put this in football terms, since we were just talking about it, she's running interference for somebody.
Yeah, I think it's Cheney, man. It's got to be Cheney. I can't wait for this to be over. You know, there's so many things. You know, there's that could happen. Karl Rove can be indicted. Scooter Libby can be indicted. You know, Andrew Card can be indicted. There's no end to how many indictments that could happen. I just want it to happen soon because I want to be here for it.
Well, you know, I want to. You're nuts. I would like to see all of this, and, you know, obviously it's going to end on the 28th of October in terms of this specific grand jury. Yeah. Now, Fitzgerald does have the power, by the way, to impanel another grand jury, possibly.
Yeah.
But my guess is whatever indictments we see, they will come out of this grand jury, and I would be very, very surprised and stunned, in fact, if this grand jury turned out to be indictment-free. In other words, if no one was found to have done anything potentially criminal coming out of this.
Well, you're not alone in that. I mean, William Kristol, the editor of the conservative rag, the Weekly Standard there, he says that he's almost certain that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's chief of staff, will be indicted. And then there's also speculation that they have plans already. If they are indicted, Karl Rove is going to either resign or go on a leave of absence and put all his efforts into defending himself against what he sees as bull accusations. He will stop being an advisor to President Bush, and he won't do it from the sidelines either, which would be interesting to watch Bush flail about without Karl Rove to act as his political penis in the world. Also, as Scooter Libby said, apparently the speculation is that he'll at least take a leave of his absence or resign as well. The two will probably go into business and make much more in the private sector than they are now.
Well, they will make a whole heck of a lot more in the private sector. I guarantee one thing. If Karl Rove takes a leave of absence, it will be a paid leave of absence while he fights these charges. And remember now, good D.C. lawyers are going to cost him a bundle to actually go into court and try and deal with all this. But I believe at a point we may see something akin to perjury being charged here. There are just too many statements made by these people that are in contradiction to other statements made by these people. And the X factor in all this, people may focus on Judith Miller because the Times wrote about her. But the focus of all this, the person whose role has still not yet been clearly delineated, is Bob Novak, the columnist who outed Valerie Plame in the first place.
Well, what do you got on that, Riley? I mean, did he cut a deal early on? He had sources as well. There's so many loose ends, and I know a lot of people are out there, the festering termites of the blog world getting at the core of this, and I appreciate that, but I hope all of this will be revealed in detail. We can only look at the timeline so much. We can only sit here and sort of pick apart our own interpretations of it and what happened in throughout the entire time in question, but it's all going to come out in the next 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, it's all going to come out in the next 2 weeks, and you know, more and more reporters are starting to focus on George W. Bush's Iraq event planners, the White House. What is it? The White House.
The Iraq group.
The Whigs. Yeah, the White House Iraq group.
Yes.
They're the ones that apparently put together the propaganda, put together the system through which this country wound up in Iraq in the first place. And I would be very surprised, actually, Mark, if none of those people came away unscathed. And watch for the roles of people like Mary Matlin and Karen Hughes, who haven't really much been discussed through all of this, but were part and parcel of this propaganda initiative.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that haven't been discussed that could go down. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, Nicholas Calio, Stephen Hadley, Scooter Libby. I mean, there have already been actions that indicate that these guys, some of these people are going to go down. And this isn't even, we got to get past this scandal and get these indictments out so we can start focusing on the Jack Abramoff investigation.
Yeah,
because that could implicate, you know, a third of the Republican Congress.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, what we're looking here at here is a group of people who acted in concert. About that, we're pretty certain at this point. They acted in concert to basically swat aside anybody who disagreed with White House policy in the run-up to the war with Iraq.
We got Monday job listing coming up. We got James Walcott coming up. You know, Bush hailed the vote in Iraq as a victory for opponents of terrorism, despite the fact that there were the deaths of 6 American soldiers on referendum day, 5 in a bomb blast in Ramadi, and one Marine was killed by a bomb in Saklawiya. These deaths bring the toll of American military lives lost in Iraq to 1,976. We're going to get into what's going on in Iraq. We talked to Borzu Doraghi, the LA Times Baghdad bureau chief down there. Is he a bureau chief? Is he? Yeah, he is. He's been a couple of things since we started talking to him, but he's a regular guest, and we talked to him in Baghdad this morning. We'll get that to you in just a second. It's 15 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
This is Wayne Gilman, better known to the hard body mamas of the greater New York metropolitan area as Newsday. When I'm not busting a cap in some jive cat's ass for hogging the printer when I'm on deadline, I'm having a funky good time with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Ooh, Newsday.
Well, look who's awake. Ready for another taste of Wayne?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program coming to you Monday live from New York City, folks, where it stopped raining over the weekend.
Yes.
Thank God. It was a beautiful reprieve. You know, I got some pictures taken of me this weekend.
Really?
Yes. I had a woman shoot pictures of me for my CD cover. You know, the CD that I had. When did I record that? A year ago?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Pretty soon it's going to come out. The reissue of Not Sold Out is out with a real cover, and it's beautiful.
It is very nice.
And the new one's going to come out. It's called Still Tickets Available. It's from the self-esteem series.
Which is going to be. You and Tony Robbins, huh?
Kind of. I'm what Tony Robbins is trying to treat. When he says, do you have this problem? And he puts a picture of me up on the wall. All right, we know a lot of you out there out of work and spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads. Well, we want to help out. We want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing. For the first time ever, Britain's super secret spy service, MI6, the inspiration for James Bond, is advertising for agents. It's true. We found the listing. For your eyes only. How would you like to be on Her Majesty's Secret Service? Now's your chance. MI6 needs qualified agents immediately. MI6 is not just the organization that the James Bond movies are based on. We're also the people who offed Princess Di. But, but mum's the word on that one. As an MI6 agent, you'll be expected to solve complex geopolitical problems in under 3 hours, including coming attractions and credit roll. Not to mention shagging the tastiest bird. In addition, qualified applicants must be able to avoid lethal derby hats, escape from shark tanks, and thwart triple-nippled supervillains. Oh, and stop any more subway bombings. Successful applicants will be outfitted with a government-issued Walther PPK handgun, Aston Martin DB5 automobile, and a license to kill. We are also accepting applicants for sex-obsessed executive secretaries and octogenarian weapons inventors. Apply today apply today, unless you're Roger Moore, in which case, please stop bothering us. We are quite aware that you're having trouble finding work. Benefits include pussy galore. Need we say any more? Did you let that go through, Chris?
Yeah, we're talking about cats, right? And it's the name of a movie.
It's a movie name. Yeah. Of course.
Hey, fictional character.
Hey, little Goliath, did that go over your head, or you just think you have submerged in some sort of weird den of your own brain? What is happening with you? You got a head full of snot, don't you?
I do. I have a cold.
Yeah?
Yes.
So that would explain why you're sort of sluggish today.
Usually he's just a bolt of lightning.
Hey, I thought it was funny, man.
Yeah.
I watch James Bond movies. You
watch the James Bond movies, too? So what did you do this weekend, big guy?
I went to a Atmosphere concert.
What is that?
It's this hip hop group.
Oh, Atmosphere. Have you heard of them, Riley?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, so that's okay. Validation in here.
Yeah.
All right. So how was that? Was that good?
I really enjoyed them, but it was kind of a weird crowd. I felt old.
Really? You felt old?
Yeah.
When you were 22.
I know. They were just high school kids.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Did you have a cathartic moment where you realized maybe I should be doing something else with my life?
No. A little bit, maybe. A little bit. I ran into this guy. This guy came up to me sat next to me.
This is going
to
be good.
His name was Jimmy Nipples.
Yeah.
And he just started doing lines of coke.
Uh-huh.
And just started talking to me. And he actually... He was like, dude.
I got to figure a guy named Jimmy Nipples got some good stories.
He started attacking me.
Yeah?
Well, because I made a stupid... He said that I asked him where he was from, and he said, I live an hour up the Hudson.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that that wasn't... I thought that was New Jersey.
Yeah.
But it's actually upstate New York.
Wow.
So he asked me if I did a lot of drugs.
The question you get asked often, I guess.
By a guy who was high on coke. So.
Yeah. You know, it's weird. I thought that story was going somewhere. That was the weirdest thing, is that there was a minute there I'm like, we're going to go somewhere. And then we ended up in New Jersey.
Well, Jimmy Nipples, lines of cocaine. You think it was going somewhere.
Lines of cocaine, up the Hudson.
Yeah.
And then, but that's, no, I'm not knocking, you know, I think it sounds like a great time.
How was the group, man?
Yeah.
How was Atmosphere? They were good.
All right.
Yeah, I enjoyed them quite a lot. Yeah.
Okay, good. This is, man, I'm telling you, if anyone doubts that we're doing quality radio here on a day-to-day basis, you know, they can just put Dave Little Goliath in their head and smoke that. I'll tell you that right now. So let's talk about Iraq. Do we have time for a Borzu sound?
I don't think so. We can talk about it a little.
Well, the thing is the Iraqi elections, it looks like the Iraqi constitution is certainly going to be passed. There was strong opposition from the Sunni population, but not enough to garner the percentages necessary to stall or defeat the passing. Initial estimates of overall turnout put it at about 61%. If it is approved, Iraq will choose a parliament in December 15th elections. Then that parliament will select a new government, which must take effect by December 31st. We talked to Borzu Daragahi. He's a staff writer for the LA Times in Baghdad a little while ago. And he said that it was not a day of rejoicing. It was a fairly somber day where Iraqis were doing what they felt like they had to do in order to move this process forward. Bush hailed the vote as a victory for opponents of terrorism despite the deaths of six American soldiers on Saturday, which was the day of the referendum votage, five in a bomb blast in Ramadi and one by a bomb in Saqaliya. The deaths bring the total toll of American military lives lost in Iraq to 1,976. That number is getting up there.
Yeah, that number is getting up there. And, they started bombing Ramadi with U.S. airstrikes late into Sunday into today, Baghdad time. And apparently 70 insurgents, or half of them civilians, depending on who you talk to, have been killed in those airstrikes.
Wow. And the real question, I think, on most people's minds about the elections in Iraq is that if the Sunnis, which they have, become more marginalized, is where do they go for support?
Good question.
Does that bolster the insurgency? Does it guarantee a protracted civil war that could last decades? Does it stall the talk of withdrawal of American troops post-election in December, or the decision on new government? I mean, these are all sort of open-ended questions. We're going to talk to James Walcott after this about the media, about that propaganda vaudeville last week. 27 past the hour, Air America.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
We'll be right back. 34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Our next guest is a contributing editor for Vanity Fair and the author of Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants, The Looting of the News in a Time of Terror. He's also written extensively about the role of Judith Miller in the New York Times in the ongoing investigation into who leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent. We're pleased to have him back once again to talk about this and more. Good morning, James Wolcott. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
It's not. Oh, yeah, sure. It's nice to see you. I always like talking to you. I like the way you write. I like the way you think, my friend. So now, let's talk about Judith Miller.
Mm-hmm.
What now? How she has any journalistic integrity or credibility at all, number one, baffles me. Number two, what do you think of her piece that came out yesterday, basically saying her version of the truth in relation to the testimony that she gave?
Well, it's in a way, her piece is less interesting than the Longer Times piece.
Oh,
because what
overview.
You learn from the Longer Times piece is that she was very divisive. Certain reporters did not want to work with her. And she was also very uncooperative with their investigation, with their own colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there's some really mysterious things. For example, here's the editor of the New York Times saying, well, we took her off the WMD beat, because clearly she had racked up a series of major mistakes, you know, going into Iraq about WMD.
Five pieces yeah. with questionable integrity.
Yeah, and then the editor says, but she sort of drifted back on her own into the security realm. And it's like, how does that work in a newspaper? Because, like, for example, at Vanity Fair, I can't drift off into assignments I'd like to do. And moreover, I can't exactly get them into the magazine.
Exactly.
So
we're not gonna print it.
Was she freelancing? Was she really doing this for the newspaper? Or was she, like, meddling? I mean, and one of the things that's so mysterious is, what is the nature of her relationship with Scooter Libby?
No kidding. Is that a romance, or what the hell is going on there?
It's so solicitous. Come back to life. I mean, that's either really creepy romantic or really creepy, like, come back to life or else.
What about that?
Come back to work.
Yeah, well, what about that closer on that letter where, quote, out west where you vacation, the aspens will already be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. Is that some sort of cryptic clandestine spy talk?
I don't know. It's very creepy. And another thing, it's not in the Times piece, and I'm still baffled by, what about the John Bolton visit to her in jail? Was that like a friendly visit, or was Bolton basically saying, hang in there, Judy, just a little bit longer, just hang in there? You know, there's so many things going on, but I really think her reputation is now completely sunk. I don't know how she can go back to the Times.
Well,
I don't know why they'd want her back, because at the end they say we incurred millions of dollars in lawyers' fees and still cannot explain to our readers what happened.
They might actually be thinking about creating an in-house newspaper at the White House that she'll be the head writer for.
Well, she could. There's a, you know, they may need it, because they've got their own problems in the PR department.
That's for sure.
You know, Jim, I don't understand something. You have at the New York Times, at the very least, in terms of who Judith Miller interacted with, or supposedly would interact with at most normal newspapers, the publisher, the executive editor, the foreign editor, the investigative editor, the managing editor, and the Washington bureau chief. Those are the ones I can come up with just off the top of my head. Yet none of these people seemingly had the power or the interest in looking into what she was doing, or telling her after Keller told her, you know, no more WMDs, telling her anything.
I know. Well, one of the things that comes through in the piece is you get the impression that, first of all, Jill Abramson, you know, the Washington Bureau Chief, doesn't like Judith Miller. I mean, there's no great ringing defense of Judith Miller. But also, you feel like she was probably overruled. I mean, and I've seen this happen at magazines where Judith Miller has a direct line to, say, the publisher or the editor. And basically, the editor says to the editors below that, just let her do it. Just let her go. Just let her, you know, and you get the feeling that, I mean, we know that Sulzberger was pushing very hard for Gail Collins to write all of these editorials defending Judith Miller. So she had, there's some personal charisma or power thing going on that bypasses all the channels, the normal channels. And this is where they got into trouble before with Jason Blair. Which is basically they said, okay, all the rules apply, but, you know, he's such a young, promising young talent. Here are things we're going to get a little haze. We're going to give him a little more leeway. It's a very, there's still so many more gaps. And all the stuff with the notebook the second notebook and yeah. Oh, where, you know.
Doesn't it make it look like, though, that the New York Times is carrying water for the administration on some level after a certain point where this woman has been sort of revealed herself to be this codependent Republican stooge that eventually if they keep enabling her to defend herself and to continue to be out there in the world with any sort of standards applied to her from the paper, that they aren't as liberal as you would think?
Well, I think there is that. I think they defer to power much more than they acknowledge. Because one of the things that comes out in the Times piece is not only couldn't they cover Judith Miller's story, but there were all sorts of tangential issues involved that they also didn't cover. That the editors basically said, no, we don't want to get into that either while she's still, you know, while this is still sort of up in the air. So the Times was getting scooped on all kinds of stories. It's sort of like, well, what are you guys in the business of? Are you there to actually break the news and report it, or are you there to play all these sort of, you know, cross-bureaucratic games? I mean, I don't understand. The whole solicitude towards Scooter Libby is just utterly baffling.
It's a weird relationship. And Riley had a good point. If she was writing a journalistic, any sort of journalistic piece on the Yellow Cake Uranium, why didn't she interview Joe Wilson? Where the hell is that in her notes?
Yeah. Why wouldn't she have talked to the person that Scooter Libby was spending so much time savaging?
Right.
It would seem logical that even if she didn't want to release Scooter Libby's name, that she would have at least gone to Wilson and say, well, a senior White House official says this about you. How do you react to that? Mm-hmm.
Well, it also it's perplexing because she claims that she asked to do a story on the Wilson business. And then Jill Abramson is saying, well, I don't know anything about that. So was Miller just off on her own? The most preposterous element, though, and a lot of the bloggers have picked up on this, is I don't know where the name Valerie
Flame came from.
It's sort of like, what? It just sort of whooshed up out of your notebook?
Yeah.
You know, it just sort of, I mean, no reporter as experienced as she is would not know where that came from. And usually you really do make a point of separating your notes so that you're not scribbling notes 2 weeks later over an interview that you did before, because you don't want to get all that stuff
mixed up.
We think that there's another source, obviously, don't you? That she's covering.
I think there is another source.
You think it's Cheney?
I think it's possible that it's Cheney. It could be another one of Cheney's sidekicks. I mean, I've heard other names thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that she could have talked to. I do think it's interesting that clearly Fitzgerald is asking about Cheney in the grand jury room.
Sure.
And it's very hard to believe that Cheney just sort of turned his back and said, okay, you kids work it all out.
No way.
Don't tell me what's going on. I mean, I'm sure Cheney gave little instructions, little hints.
Yeah.
And
he was at the CIA every other day.
Right. And again, it's very interesting the fact that people are non-showing. The only thing I've seen Cheney do recently is, of course, Fox News, because he knows he'll get a friendly audience there. He did an interview. But otherwise, Cheney, for example, pulled out of the National Review gala.
He
didn't do that. Karl Rove pulled out of a fundraiser yesterday.
Good.
And they said Ken Melvin instead.
Yikes.
Can you imagine?
Oh, that ought to be fun.
You're waiting for Karl Rove, the inside poop. Then there's Ken Melvin. We're looking forward to the 2006 midterms.
Great.
Wow, that's kind of like an understudy sort of thing, like in a play.
Yeah. Well, I think what it is I don't know if Rove thinks he's going to be indicted, but he clearly, I think he did not want to face the fact that there would have been press outside that event. He did not want to, like, have people shouting questions at him.
He's like a cave fish, you know. When he's out in public, he looks all weird and albino-y and kind of, like, you know, creepy.
And he clearly loves what he can control, which is that, you know, he's in the room, he picks up the phone, he makes it happen. He spills poison into someone's ear and, like, get this done.
Yeah,
now he's just not in control of any of this.
Nothing. He's not even in control of the hurricanes anymore. He's really... we're going to talk about, speaking about audiences in terms of receptive audiences, why don't we talk about that little, vaudeville propaganda act that happened in Iraq last week.
The little pit.
Oh, the event planner, Lombardo.
Let's play a little bit of this improvisational conversation that President Bush had with this soldier, Christine Lombardo, he did not identify her as a flack for the military, but she is. And then we'll talk to Jim about it.
We began our fight against terrorism in the wake of 9/11, and we're proud to continue it here in North Central Iraq. I can tell you over the past 10 months, we've seen a tremendous increase in the capabilities and the confidences of our Iraqi security force partners. We've been working side by side, training and equipping 18 Iraqi Army battalions. Since we began our partnership, they have improved greatly, and they continue to develop and grow into sustainable forces.
There you go. That was Master Sergeant Corrine, Lombardo. Military FLAC. A FLAC is somebody who does PR for the organization. Now, this whole thing, is there anybody out there, Jim, honestly, I mean, this must be worth the risk to them to be found out, because they were found out by the mainstream media are there people that believe this crap, that this person is actually having a conversation, that this isn't talking points coming off a page?
I don't know, because, you know, I actually tuned on to it by accident before I knew anything about, you know, that they had been prepped. And it looked so bad, just as TV.
Yeah.
It looked like a really stilted school play. You had these soldiers sitting there on risers, you know, their knees bunched up together, and then smiles on their face, and then Bush, you know, taking these things back and forth. And I thought, who is this possibly going to convince at this point?
Right, exactly.
But I'll tell you what it is. I really think this is all post-Katrina, because Bush was unengaged then, or disengaged. He was slow on the uptake. He was slow to respond. So everything the White House is doing now is, we want to make the president look on top of things, plugged in, interested, you know? And so they set up this little thing. But what I love is when you see the full footage of the woman telling the soldiers what it's like. I mean, you've done a lot of TV. It really is like there's always like a real whipcracker on the set of the show.
Oh, yeah,
and
it's
basically like, no, you're not supposed to be here right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you felt like she was going to tell those Marines, you sit yourself down, mister, until we're done with this.
Right.
You know, and the way she was coaching them was so embarrassing, that these are our fighting men. And she's saying, now that you pass the microphone over to the, you know, sergeant, and it's,
Event planners. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's embarrassing because, I mean, you know, the way that he's been using soldiers as props, I mean, from the mission accomplished on, it's really humiliating and degrading to the troops.
Yeah, he's actually killing some of those props.
But, you know, they seem to want to foster this belief that there's some progress. Wherever they find it, there's got to be progress. And I think that's what they stage that whole thing for.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's talk, you know, let's continue this conversation in a minute or two and talk a little bit about how the media is sort of celebrating they're taking initiative again, that there is some sort of momentum out there saying, like, the media's back on it. They're doing their job. I'm sure you got some thoughts about that. Our guest is Jim Walcott, contributing editor of Vanity Fair, author of Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants. We'll be back with him in a second. 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Let's put this thing down. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Our guest is James Walcott. Just want to thank John out there. He sent us a stack of CDs that
he recorded
himself at Red Rocks. Willie Nelson, Tom Petty, everybody. We did get them, and I appreciate that. I've been listening to them. I like the Tom Petty one. We are talking to Jim Walcott. We are talking about the media. The question that I posited before took this short intermission was, it seems like the news organizations, that at least some of the big networks and the cable networks, are starting to actually take responsibility and do some real reporting. Is it because they realize that the ship is sinking and they don't have to kiss any more butt, or what?
I think that's part of it. I think sinking poll numbers have sort of emboldened them. I don't know if a year or two ago they would have shown us the footage of those soldiers being coached. They might not have. Mm-hmm. I find it hard to believe that for example, NBC News led with it for like 4 minutes.
Wouldn't they have been carrying it? I mean, live, perhaps?
Well, I don't know. But I think that they would have, if they had covered it at all, they would have treated it very minor, because it would have been like, well, this could undermine the war effort. I think part of what's happening is we're seeing the receding of fear. I think people have been afraid It's hard to keep the fear level up after 2001, and that's so much of what Bush used to enforce obedience. Now, the cable news things, I mean, I do notice that they're going back to, I mean, we still have missing co-eds and like that. But what I think one of the comedies is as CNN is getting a little more aggressive, Fox News is getting much more defensive. I mean, if you watch the Fox News All-Stars, that Brit Hume show, first of all, they don't think that the Harriet Myers nomination is in any trouble at all. They scoff at, they're saying, oh, this is all this, you know, it's a few bloggers and Hill staffers, and it's not gonna.
Wow.
Last week I saw.
Sam Brownback is a blogger?
Yeah, well, last week I saw Bill Salmon, who's one of the biggest hacks, he was on the Brit Hume show, saying, you know, if you look at those Bush poll numbers, they're not really as bad as they see at first. So they're sort of doing, and of course they don't think, A, that there will be any indictments out of the Blame investigation, or that there should be. So Fox News is sort of, they're getting into a defensive huddle.
Mm-hmm. They're trying to bend reality on their own impulse. Mm-hmm. They are doing the bidding of the president no matter what. I don't understand how people can continue to buy this crap. I just don't get it, Jim. That, you know, clearly most of what they're talking about it's lies. It's bent information. Yet people still gravitate towards it. I don't know. Is it because those are the people that are still buying the fear frame or?
Well, I think there's that. You know, Bill Schneider, CNN, who I don't really have any respect for, but he did say something about the poll numbers for Bush. He said, right now, Bush has his base, and that's it.
Right. Yeah.
He's got his base. And Fox News is really part of the base.
Right.
And I think that's who they appeal to. But all the other people, the moderates, the independents, they've been shaved off. They've jumped ship. So I think Fox is just like, it's sort of like with Rush Limbaugh. But even Rush Limbaugh has sort of turned on Harriet Myers.
Well, I tell you, it's very exciting for me. I can feel it in the clubs when I do stand-up. There was a period in time where you'd be critical of the president, and people who were critical of the president were afraid to go, woohoo, you know? Yeah. But now the entire thing has shifted. And certainly in New York, when you start saying negative things about this president, it's back to that, like, yes, you know, there's a momentum behind it because the conservatives, a lot of them are just broken.
Yeah, I think it's true. And one of the things that's going to be very interesting is if we do get the Blame indictments, one thing about television is they love trials.
Yes.
They love bringing on the prosecutors. They love bringing in the defense attorneys. They love the notion of who's going to be called as a witness.
And legal analysts.
Legal analysts. They love that stuff. And so if there are certain high-level indictments, there's no way that the press at that point can sit on anything.
It's going to be exciting.
It's going to be nightly. It's going to be, you know, Watergate light.
Great. Our guest has been Jim Walcott, contributing editor of Vanity Fair. His book, Attack Poodles and Other Media Mutants, available. Is it in paperback yet?
No.
Okay. There's the. Thanks for being with
me. Thanks for being so honest, Jim.
There's the facts from the Streisand compound. It's time for this week's liberal agenda. Here are your marching orders. Write them down. One, if you're not very popular at home or at work, declare a terror alert and see if it raises your numbers. Two, now that even conservatives are criticizing George Bush, find yourself defending him as an oppressed minority. Just kidding. We smell blood. It's good. Three, tell Major League Baseball to avoid stereotyping. Come up with a term other than stealing a base if the player is African-American. Republish Harriet Myers' letter to George Bush, replacing the words warmest regards with I ache for you. Five, urge rap artists to replace the terms bitches and hoes with life partners and sex workers. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Now the Republicans want to cut back on the mortgage tax exemption. Hey, that's going to hurt them more than anyone. They're the ones who mortgaged the future. Wake up, sheeple. It's time to make a payment on your house of pain.
Now, Maron, tomorrow we're going to have someone in to talk about the 10 best hotels in New York to have an affair in. I will be recusing myself from that conversation.
Yeah, I think I will, too. But maybe we can talk about the past.
Yeah, well.
Like back in the day.
Way back in the day. We also got the liberal confessional and the product placement minute. It's been a lot of fun. Jim, thanks a million, man. You are listening to Air America Radio.